Group meeting, Sunday, 6th April, 1986. I would say, no, we cannot know for certain the content or meaning of eternal verities. The question arises, are there eternal verities? When we use the word verity, we mean a statement of truth, a statement of fact. But a statement in words, a concept in thought, exists only in the sphere of the finite and the temporal. We cannot, the eternal, the infinite, is inconceivable, unthinkable. One can't talk about it. So when we use a phrase like the eternal verities, or in ordinary prose we say the eternal hills and so on, we are really misusing the word eternal in that context. Because the manifested, whatsoever is manifested, and a thought, and any sort of expression of a truth, is a temporal thing. It cannot be eternal. The statement. The implication actually is that that which is of the nature of ultimate reality, the supreme truth, is eternal. Its context is the eternal and infinite. But having said that, one really shouldn't say anything more. But as I have written here, the phrase is a very telling phrase, making a strong impact upon our minds. Now, religious truth is an inexhaustible wellspring. As we keep on seeing in the present, our minds keep on producing intellectual formulations. Our task is to sift them and not to hold on to them. Where there is pure understanding, we do not cling to the verbal formulation, but let it go as and when necessary, and that is when one has deeper insight and sees that the old formulation doesn't really hold good anymore for you yourself. It is a very individual matter. The truth seeker studies in order to free his mind from what he is studying. This is no condemnation of the study of comparative religion. Indeed, the comparative religionist may find that the fruits of his labor have been thankfully utilized in these pages. The important thing is that the mind, if it is sane, if it is whole and pure, must be completely open to the fresh discovery of truth. The mind must be free, and every inquiry must be a free inquiry. unhampered by any predetermination. Of course, practically nobody in the world ever does that. It takes a truly enlightened being, a perfected holy one, to be able to do it. Because we receive our impressions through all our sense organs. And because the brain is already conditioned and taught how to interpret sense organs, sense impressions, we interpret all that we receive from outside only in accord with our particular conditioning. And this is the difficulty. We are not able to see, to hear, and to think even, completely afresh, as if for the first time. And it is really necessary to be able to do so if we are keen upon seeing the truth. You may ask why. The whole world is continuously changing. Change is the unchanging characteristic of the entire world process. And the impressions that we receive of the world process, therefore, are impressions which belong to a changed world and a continuously changing world. You see? Therefore, what we have seen and experienced previously must not be clung to if we are to experience in full the new kind of impression which comes to us. One may say, but if I look at a wall, for instance, I've looked at that wall for 40, 50, 60, 100 years. It's the same old wall. Is it? Is it? It may appear to be the same old wall, but in actual fact it has undergone some sort of change. It needs a fresh coat or some such thing, you see, and so forth. And far more important, I who am looking at that wall have changed considerably during this period of time. So my interpretation inside myself, my conscious awareness of that wall, is necessarily a different kind of awareness from what it was 10 days ago, 10 years ago, and so on. It's different. This capacity to be fresh in one's mind continuously is a very important element in being in tune with the truth. So, if we approach our theme of the heart of religion as a whole, we may see the varied unfoldings of the religiousness of mankind. The word of the different scriptures presents wide disagreements and also intimate harmonies. All these throw light on each other. And if only our eyes have been well washed by the tears of our hearts longing for truth, we shall see its wonderful richness displayed in the variety of its expressions, and we may understand any and every religion all the better for it. Intellect is arrogant and immodest. When critical, it rends and ravishes. Wisdom is meek and chaste. When understanding, it heals and unifies. The open-minded inquiry is a wise inquiry, reverent and grateful. Grateful because it enables us to be nearer and nearer the truth as such. One of its faithful servants is doubt, the humble but searching doubt of truth-seeking. Always question, challenge. The question must be a challenge. Is this so? Is this really so? And if one looks with an open mind all the time, then one will discover the changing process in its entirety. It challenges all authority, but not with the insolent self-assertiveness of the ignorant. You know how some people can never converse with one without saying, "Oh, I do not agree with that at all. I disagree. I think so and so. I think so and so." He's presuming that he is capable of thinking. The first noble truth of Buddhism, for example, states that birth is sorrowful, old age, decay, death are all sorrowful. This statement is taken at face value. So too is the belief in reincarnation by the faithful of the Buddhist and Hindu world. Millions of Christians accept literally the teachings of the Immaculate Conception and Virgin Birth, and the resurrection and ascension of Jesus. Are such beliefs true? If there is truth hidden in them, what is that truth? Is it what has been popularly believed through the centuries? Again, it is not rare to come across such statements as dangerously near to pantheism, oriental fatalism, negativity, nihilism, but this is Gnosticism. One constantly hears statements like that. And there are no grounds really for such statements. What value is there in such statements apart from telling us something about the mind and character of those who make them? One more example will suffice. The founders of some great religions are presented as perfect and holy men who triumphed over temptation and lived sinless lives, and who had supernatural powers and performed miracles. In short, they are presented as stylized pictures of perfection, and in at least two cases, as embodiments of deity, deity itself incarnate. I think the two cases are Sri Krishna. Millions of Hindus believe Sri Krishna was the deity incarnate, and Jesus. Now, if you take things like Immaculate Conception and virgin birth, there are interpretations, psychological interpretations, which are near the facts of the situation. biological conception involves concupiscence, sexual desire. How does spiritual conception come into being? When there is no desire, possessive desire involved, then in that state where the heart is perfectly empty and open, and the mind too is perfectly open, there emerges an insight which is a true conception. True for the time being and for that particular person. And since no concupiscence, no possessiveness, no passion has been involved in it, it is an immaculate conception. Christendom believes in the parthenogenetic birth of Jesus. Now, parthenogenesis is a phenomenon which is characteristic of a certain kind of virus. I have forgotten the name of the virus, but I'll look it up and let you know if you want sometime. And there is no special virtue in parthenogenesis as such. The natural process of procreation is miracle enough to confound a sextillion of infidels. But people don't appreciate that. I myself feel that where the heart of religion is concerned, whatever purifies and perfects a man, relates him fully to life, and allows and enables the realization of the transcendent, that is religion. It's a simple outlook, and I believe it is free of most of the absurdities that get associated with religion as such. And there's no such thing as this is the true religion, the ultimate religion, the final truth. There is no finality whatsoever in the entire manifested universe and in the process of manifestation. There is only continuous change. The void holds within itself the creative power which brings forth the plenitude. And that plenitude, as it comes forth, is perpetually new. That is why that is creation and not procreation. All that we call creation with regard to the work of poets, artists, scientists, philosophers, and so on, is only cultural procreation. The difference between creation and procreation, as far as I see it, is just this, that whatsoever is procreated is true to type. If you compose a symphony, it is true to the type of music which is regarded as symphony. If you write a sonnet, it is true to the type which is regarded as a sonnet. You see? But that is procreation. Human beings cannot create, biologically. They can only procreate, and they can only procreate other human beings. They cannot procreate mosquitoes, nor can mosquitoes procreate elephants. So you see, everything is procreated, that is procreated, is true to type. Creation in its actuality is something utterly new. There is no type involved. There is no before, something previous to it. It is beginning in the absolute meaning. We say, in the beginning, this, that and the other happened. That is not really true. Where eternity is concerned, beginning, the present, the past, the present, the future, just don't exist. Apart from existing as potentiality in simultaneity. The past, the present and future exist potentially in simultaneity in eternity. I can't explain that in any sort of logical way further than just saying that. Whoso can retell the holiness of the old scriptural word in terms of realization effectively serves his age and milieu. Such is the saint, the poet seer, the yogi, the mystic, provided he is a real yogi and not like some of the large number of professionals we see in some continents. If he is one who spontaneously lives it, if he is the embodiment of wisdom and the heart of love, if he is one who utters the new word and makes the new affirmation, then a new world teacher is in our midst. He who utters the new word and the new affirmation. How is it possible for a new word and a new affirmation to come along? As I said a few moments ago, the world is continuously changing. And that change can be progressive, it can be regressive, it can be just fortuitous change as such. If we are concerned with truth, with obtaining insights, true insights into the reality as such, then that reality must necessarily be expressed in terms of the time and the situation in which oneself is. And that time and situation is always a different time and situation from that which prevailed some time back. So it becomes a new word. And what is it that has the perhaps the most powerful influence, particularly in our century and particularly in this latter part of the century, than the discoveries of science itself? Right in the beginning of the century, science destroyed the separation, the fixed separation between the material and the immaterial, when it began to discover the interconvertibility of energy, which is immaterial, and mass, which is material. So that separating wall, which had its influence in all past centuries upon and made man think of the spiritual as something which is the perfect and wonderful, and the material which is something perishing and evil and so forth. That necessarily had to go, because they are interchangeable. The material and the immaterial are interchangeable. And it can be demonstrated scientifically. It can be actually demonstrated. Therefore, what we have called spirit and what we have called matter and regarded as irreconcilable opposites and enemies, in fact, you see, all those ideas must necessarily go. And in saying this, this is of the nature of a new word and a new affirmation. But it is science which helps us all along the line in that process. If you study the history of the development of religious ideas and the growth of insights which people have had for the last 3,000 years, the Greeks were very considerably responsible for starting all this. You will find that with the new conceptions, the new knowledge about the nature of things has had the most powerful influence of all in producing a different theology, a new theology. And one of the best examples is in Christendom. Roman Catholic theology, which first came into being, was produced by Saint Augustine of Hippo, and he based his theology upon the idealism of Plato and the teachings of Christ. Not only the idealism of Plato, but the scientific ideas prevailing in those days due to Duke Democritus, particularly, who was a member of his school and who first postulated an atomic theory. The atom was indestructible, indivisible, and created for all time. It was supposed to be eternal. And the ideas of God, which were presented after the 5th and 6th centuries BC, were also in tune with those ideas about the nature of the atom. The self-subsistent, the eternal, the indestructible, and the indivisible. Those ideas came into the new word of religion as such. And that underwent a considerable change, when St. Thomas Aquinas produced a slightly, well, in some respects considerably different theology in the 13th century. St. Augustine flourished in the 4th and 5th centuries, Augustine in the 13th century. He was influenced, as a matter of fact, the whole of the Roman Catholic Church had already received a severe shock with the translation, the Latin translations by Arabian scholars of Aristotle. Aristotle disagreed considerably with his teacher Plato. Aristotle was Plato's most brilliant pupil, and really speaking, the father of all science to come after him. And St. Thomas Aquinas, studying the physics and psychology of Aristotle, produced a new theology. The Catholic Church took some time before it accepted that theology, and it did not it did not discard Augustine's theology. Both theologies form the basis of all Catholic theology as such. But perhaps the slightly greater emphasis got laid upon St. Thomas Aquinas' theology because it was more in line with the scientific facts which were known by that time. Now, with the modern scientific facts which we know, the Roman Catholic Church is concerned with producing a theology which will fit in with those scientific developments. So you see, the material, science and mathematics and so on, are concerned with the material world very considerably. The material influences what was regarded as the exclusive milieu of the spiritual. The spiritual also interacts with the material. They both act upon each other. In our own personal lives, it works this way. You have heard me say time and again, merely to hold an idea which seems quite true, or to have a belief, is not good enough. You have to become conscious of the thing, if it is the truth that you seek. If you are really conscious of something, then through all your thinking and feeling, your speech and your action, that truth will express itself spontaneously and naturally. But you have to, it is a matter of innermost consciousness. And at the same time, this is partly due to what I have experienced for myself. Our thought and feeling, our speech and action also acts back upon consciousness. Our innermost consciousness is influenced by all our thought and feeling, speech and action. And this, of course, works in very neatly into a vision of the total of the world, the whole world, as a one total reality. There is no separation. There is no sinning against the unitary wholeness of the totality. The fundamental meaning of the word sin is that which hurts or tries to break the unity of the universe. You see, we have the right words in our languages. Universe, for example. What does it mean? It is derived from unus, the Latin unus, meaning one, and vertere, to turn. And the word universe literally means turned into a unity. That's its literal meaning. But we are not conscious of that meaning. We take it as a string of words, an idea, a thought. If we really became conscious of this unity of the universe, our whole existential life, thought, feeling, word and action, you see, would never produce anything to hurt that unity, to spoil it. And in holistic consciousness, we do become conscious of that unity. Therefore, the perfected Holy One is regarded as one who is all-loving, all-wise, all-good, all-beautiful. It's important to realize this, because otherwise this inherited through literally hundreds of millions of years of evolution, where the brain is concerned, this inherited and imposed belief and idea that the spiritual is this, the material is that, this is good, that is evil. That's a hopeless state to be in. It's a state of continual warfare within ourselves. And you see, what is true for the universe is true for each and every one of us. Because each and every one of us is a microcosm, a small cosmos. And what does the Greek word cosmos mean? It means order, complete relationship, justice, truth, and so forth. And it is related, of course, this is related to the Vedic Ritha, which means precisely those things, order, justice, truth, and so forth, you see. Which is related to the word, to the Avastan word, which Zarathustra taught, Asha. That word Asha underwent several modifications. It became Arsh, Eresh, Artha, Eretha. And Eretha is definitely related to the Rig Vedic Ritha. Eretha, Ritha. And the meaning is the same. So, now all this can be investigated by us, provided our investigation is wholly open-minded, ready to receive the truth, which means a devotion to truth, a devotion to reality. What is devotion? It is that kind of love which enables one to give one's whole self totally to truth. How many of us have that kind of love, that kind of devotion? In actual fact, many a scientist is a wonderful example of devotion to truth. Although he also suffers considerably, as Eddington pointed out in his Dharma lectures in the 1930s, he also has his sort of inner conditioning which makes him want to see his experiments produce the result that they ought to produce in accord with his mathematical theory. But to be totally open-minded is one of the most difficult things. Only the void is totally open-minded. You know, there are some wonderful lines by Shelley in his Adonais. How does it go? Heaven's light shines forever. Earth's shadows fly. Life, like a dome of many-colored glass, stains the white radiance of eternity. Die if thou wouldst find that which thou dost seek. He was talking of seeking the innermost things in the previous verses and so forth, you see. Die if thou wouldst find what thou dost seek. Follow where all else is fled. where all else is fled, is the void, which is the creative source of the plenitude. You know, if we could study English poetry quite open-mindedly, with the religious spirit quite awake in us, we would find all that we find in the best of all the religions of the world. And I should imagine that other poetry is also the same. I don't know any other poetry, I only know a little bit about English poetry, that's all. Well, that finishes chapter 3, after 1 year and 3 months. Well, actually not 1 year, because we missed out so many months. Well, we have had about 12 meetings. No, sorry, we have had only 9 meetings with this book.